What is going on, everybody? Welcome to a very special episode of Movie Mondays here on the Heroes for Hire podcast. My name is Conor Lawler, and joining me, as always, is my best pal, Mr. Sean Meehan. Sean, how's it going?
Very, very excited, very happy, Conor. Been waiting to talk about this.
Well, the thing is, Sean, I don't know if you know, but we are actually discussing Dune Part 2 this week. I don't know if you know.
Oh, I was planning on talking about Pirates of the Caribbean, but that's fine. Yeah, no, we can talk
Madame
about
Web again. We were doing a review of Madame Web. So if we're going to drop this, this is going to be a bit of a special episode. We don't normally put out a second review or a second episode for on Mondays throughout the month. We have our Movie Monthlies episodes, but this movie we felt was so big, it needed a review.
It kind of deserved it. It warranted its own episode.
So this movie and The Batman 2 are really the only two things that probably might break the streak.
And The Batman 2 is coming out soon, correct?
No, no, Sean. Don't fucking bring up that bad juju.
Sorry. Please. Warner Brothers has no money. It's hilarious.
If anyone hasn't heard, it got pushed back to 2020 fucking 29 or something. I can't remember, but it was not good.
It's rough. It's a rough time to be alive.
So Dune 2, Sean, we actually reviewed Dune 1 on the podcast. And what happened in that one was you have read all of the books, correct?
Yes. I've read the ones that Frank Herbert wrote, not the ones that his son wrote after he died. But yeah.
Is that the first four?
First six.
Okay, you've read the first six. Okay, so you're fully ingrained.
Yeah.
I have not read anything, and I have only seen the movies.
Okay, are we doing... How about we do spoilers for Dune Part 1 and 2 and the book Dune, but I won't spoil anything from any later books.
Fantastic. Now, you will probably have to touch on that when it comes to the baby, but that's
bit.
Just... True osmosis with you, I kind of know these things, but ultimately I don't know a lot. So I think it works. I know kind of where we're going, vaguely, but I don't know how we get there.
You have broad strokes, whereas I
broad
have
strokes.
Like... full prescient vision of what's coming up.
My biggest memory of Dune 1, the Dune 1 review, is me going, oh, jeez, I take this and this, and you having a knowing look in your face, like, that's interesting. That's interesting that you think that.
Whoa, you came to that conclusion, did you?
So before we get into this, could you give us, if this is your first episode, if you're just tuning into the Dune review, welcome. If this is your second or more episode, we would really appreciate a like, a follow on all of the socials or on Spotify and iTunes. Could you give us a 5-star review on whatever podcast platform that you're listening to this on? It would really, really help us out. Just through algorithms.
It gets us in front of more ears. And if you get to the end of the episode and you liked it, there is a heap of other movie reviews over on our Patreon. If you want to check out that. It's usually comic book or nerdy movies or sometimes just trash.
For example, last month's review was Madame Web. That's over at the Patreon now. And that was a fantastic movie that is probably better than this movie.
Oh, 100%. Way better.
Sorry,
I had to bless myself after I said that.
I said probably. So, Sean, where would you like to start with Dune Part 2?
Okay. I think... this movie picks up basically immediately after Dune Part 1 finishes.
Yeah, like minutes later.
Minutes later, they're just being inducted into the Fremen peoples. There's so much to cover, because it's such a big movie. So much happens, and everything... the easiest thing to say in the world, this movie looks amazing.
Yeah, it does.
I don't know how it's made for $190 million, because...
Well, I mean, the good news is Secret Invasion was made for $210 million.
Good, so we hit all of those shady tax dealings that we've done.
Because once you know that Secret Invasion was made for $210 and this was made for $190, the questions really begin to mount of, what's going on over there? What's happening? Like, this team, by the way, the team behind this movie, the whole cast, the whole crew, it's genuinely like the Harlem Globetrotters have showed up. Like, it's the all-star team.
There's
that
no
have
weak
assembled.
Link. Like, there's no sneak in at the end there.
Well, I'm going to say it right. So Hans Zimmer obviously does the music. Might be Hans Zimmer, might be his assistant, but Hans Zimmer's assistant is also super good.
Yeah, and who, and also is paid for their work as well.
Yeah, I assume. Not only that, but on cinematography, which is, I mean, in this movie, I feel like we should say this up front. We're probably not going to mention it in every single scene.
Yeah.
But every scene in this movie is fucking amazing and drop-dead gorgeous in how it looks.
Such a treat to get shots that are well-composed and blocked out correct, like, with intention, with purpose.
Like,
and everything feels real.
I think it might be one of the most beautiful movies I've ever seen. I'm not saying I think, I know. It is one of the most beautiful movies I've ever. Like, it has no right to be this good. It's a sci-fi movie about random planets.
Yeah.
How
none
does
of this should
nice?
Work. Like, but it just does.
Greg Fraser is on the cinematography, who also did The Batman.
The Batman. All of the stuff that's shot with Christopher Walken's The Emperor, the lens that's used on that is the same lens that is used throughout the Batmobile chase. Because it makes the background all fucked up and wibbly. Very, very, very cool.
So Greg Fraser, obviously, he's literally, I'd say he's probably top two cinematographers in the world, top three. Like, he's really fucking up there. And we're not even getting to the cast, but like, so, okay, you got Hans Zimmer on the music, Greg Fraser is on the cinematography, and then you got Denis Villeneuve as the director.
A man who has been storyboarding this since he was a teenager.
I mean, like, I think he might be, in my opinion, I don't want to say it for everyone, but in my opinion, he's the best working director today. Like, in the world.
He's the best and most unsung, generally, I would say.
Look, Christopher Nolan and Greta Gerwig are fucking outstanding, right?
Yeah.
Like, we're not saying that they're not great at the moment, right? But I just think Denis doesn't miss. Like, I've never seen him miss.
The man has an amazing track record with putting out fantastic films.
He did Arrival. That's enough.
Also, we're just assuming, by the way, you liked this movie, right?
This is one of the greatest movies I've ever seen in my whole life, yes.
Excellent. We're on the same page.
Cool. Great. Is it better than one?
I think one is more interesting. More stuff happens in two. I prefer Chalamet in two. I think he really steps it up in the acting department. Maybe because he's given more to do and there's more character change that takes place over this movie, but I just found him way more interesting to watch this side of
I think the presence of this movie makes one better. So by that proxy, I think two is a better one, just because if it makes number one better just by its existence.
Yeah. Part of me really wants to watch him back to back.
Oh, what an experience that'd be.
That'd be insane, I think.
I mean, okay, I rewatched one again, and I mean, like, you've got the father.
Oscar Isaac.
I mean, Oscar Isaac's beard and hair in number one might carry it to a better movie. I think
this
beard
is
game is too strong. And also that scene of them in the cemetery, when he's like, even if you don't want to be the king, you'll still always be my son. And I'm like, fucking hell.
Which leads us nicely on to the topic of departures from the books. That kind of thing didn't really happen in the Dune book. Also, this is the best adaptation of Dune I think you could possibly do. Changes and all. I think they're changes for good reasons.
That's a very good point that we can kind of delve into, because maybe this isn't the perfect adaptation of what is in the book. So what's exactly in the book to screen, maybe that's not. But what fascinates me about this movie and number one is I was watching it like, how is he doing this? Like, it shouldn't be possible for this movie to be good. And I think I said that in part one. This movie has no right to be this good. Like, it takes a level of talent to transfer that batshit book. And especially the next few that I know go insane.
Very insane.
But like, to get it from that book onto this screen is possibly one of the most amazing achievements I've ever seen in cinema.
100%. And the one thing I would say about this movie, and it's not even a critique, it's more of just an observation, is that this doesn't feel like the end of the story. when you read the first Dune book, it's intended, like, it was intended as, hey, this is the story and this is it, and there is a start, middle, and end. Because we are now making this in the years after all of the other books came out, we know Dune Messiah is going into production, it's going to be made. There's things set up in this movie that aren't necessarily... that there's things set up in this movie purely because they know they have a third one coming. So it doesn't feel like a full end of a story. It feels like the Two Towers, if that makes sense. Like,
which, I mean, the Lord of the Rings trilogy is one of the greatest trilogies of all time.
100%.
And that's another one of those where everyone was watching it like, how are they doing this?
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you a very unfair question, Sean, right now, and say which one is better.
Oh my God. I'll say Lord of the Rings at the minute because it's finished.
Look, that's an easy out. I respect the hustle. Go on.
So, I like the it's because there is more story to tell now than there was when the first book came out. We don't get the full story. Not everything is resolved at the end of Dune Part 2 as it is at the end of Dune the book. We do need Dune Messiah to finish certain story threads.
Mm.
That's the only observation I would have about the differences between the adaptations. That might not be the greatest thing, but I will watch Dune Messiah in a heartbeat. No one's going to like it, but I'll watch it.
Wait, that guy's Hitler. That's going to happen a lot.
Dune Messiah was written because at the end of Dune, the book, everyone thought Paul was the hero and Frank Herbert had to be like, no, he's like, really
Frank
not.
Frank Herbert is just sitting there like with his hands, like he's like crunching his nose, just like his two fingers, and he's just like, oh, fuck these fucking idiots. No, he's clearly Hitler. I don't know how much I need to stress this. And fucking hell.
There's one scene I need to talk about. We're not doing this in order. We don't do these in order because our minds jump around too much.
Yeah.
But the scene when he goes south and he decides to, he does the Water of Life and he becomes the Kwisatz Haderach and then he goes into the Siege to talk to everyone.
Yeah.
I was sitting forward in the cinema. I was locked in because, like, Chalamet fucking kills it in that
scene. I think that's literally the scene that a lot of people, I've heard from a lot of people, and they're like, that's the scene when Timothy Chalamet kind of, on screen, everyone's like, oh, I get it. Oh, yeah. He's fucking amazing.
Yeah. It's like, not that he was holding back, but just like, he stops being Paul at that point, and now he's Muad'Dib.
Yeah, and like, he's full on, just like, he's gone into dictator mode of just like, I know what's right for all of you, and you are bowing down to me.
Yeah, and there's even like, and it changes so much when he's like, he's having that conversation with his mother before a lot of the people leave south, and he's like, that's not faith, that's wrong.
That's propaganda. He's always like, that's propaganda, which it is, because the Bene Gesserit went south many generations ago and they were like, somebody's coming.
Yeah.
Somebody's coming, and when they do arrive, you have to fucking follow them. They
such
are
a good
one.
Line as well. I love, so in the books, there isn't that much non-belief, but like this, they make a point, like Chani is like, you're not the fucking Messiah. Like, that's a myth they made up to control us.
And they do a really good job of, like, them saying, like, Chani's from the north.
Yeah.
And Javier Bardem's character is from the south. So whatever the Bene Gesserit did worked in the south, and it maybe didn't quite get all the way to the north. So the northern people are still like, that seems like a bunch of bollocks, to be honest. And the southern people are like, I fully believe it.
Because the south is like, it's more removed from the Imperium because there's all these sandstorms, it's harder to get down there. So that myth has just been gestating for generations.
And the northern people are probably more likely to be dealing with the fucking Harkonnens on a day-to-day basis. They don't have time to let it circulate
exactly.
And like build up a sort of myth around it because they're like just trying to live day-to-day.
Yeah, and they've just made, they've gotten their own way of surviving. That there's not as much of a need for a Messiah because they're like, we can do this ourselves.
Yeah.
So I,
whereas the southern people probably see the Harkonnens and people who come to the planet as more like mythological people. If you never see them, you're like, oh, well, there's a messiah coming that'll save us. So we just need to sit tight. And we don't even have to do any battle. We just sit here. And he'll eventually arrive.
Something that's come up with like friends and stuff is like it wasn't just Arrakis that was done on. It's called the Missionaria Protectiva. And just on various undeveloped worlds, the Bene Gesserit just start these rumours in case a Bene Gesserit is ever stuck there.
Now look, there is a massive conversation to be had about religion and like all this stuff, and like Frank Herbert very much wants to get into that stuff, is that like the less you have, the more likely it is that you will believe in some sort of messiah, because you need something to aspire, or something has to come along to save you from whatever situation that you are in.
That is a through line throughout a lot of the books, that humanity just needs something to believe in.
Like especially when you have nothing.
Yeah, and like the most dangerous thing, this is like a quote that he has, the most dangerous thing that can happen to a society is for an inspiring leader to rise up. Because it's just going to cause trouble.
Yeah, because what eventually happens is that they become... It overwhelms them, and then they are no longer them, which is exactly what happens to Paul.
Yeah, Paul literally becomes a different person in this movie.
Yeah, like he starts the movie as a person, and then 2 hours in, his personality changes with one drink.
Yeah.
And the change is because he sees everything. He sees every possible future and every possible... And once you have that in your brain, like... He's no longer Paul. Like, Paul doesn't exist anymore.
That's the thing. There's too much going on. And, like, he sees they touch on it. They nearly fucking say it. There's a bit where he's talking to his mother after he wakes up. And he's like, oh, Channy will come around. I've seen it.
Yeah.
He's like, I've seen everything. There's one straight line through that if we follow that, everything will be okay. And that's when, first of all, he's locked into that now. He's like, okay, I can't do anything else. I don't have free choice anymore, basically.
Yeah.
That's a thing in Dune called the Golden Path. They nearly fucking say it in this movie, and it gives me hope that there'll be more movies after it. But it's the one way. It's Doctor Strange, the 14,605,000.
Yeah, there's only one scenario where we survive this battle.
Yeah, exactly. And we have to follow it like this. But the curse is that he has to follow it like this. He can't change anything. He just has to live through it, even if it's terrible.
And he knows it's terrible because he's seen it. Like, he knows, like, millions upon billions of people are going to die.
Yeah. And it's also, someone tweeted this, and I had noticed it, but what it does to the Fremen as well. So at the start of this movie, the first scene is the Fremen recovering water from bodies.
Yeah.
And they're even like, look, we can't drink it, but it's useful. We can use it in machines to cool them and stuff like that. The water is very, very precious.
Water is the life source.
Exactly. And to the point where, like, they'll take it from themselves and they die, it goes into the big pool. And then at the end of this movie, the Fremen are burning bodies.
Yeah.
Like, they're doing, like, it's changed everything.
They don't care.
No. They just... Because now... They're free, basically, is what they think.
Because Paul has told them he's going to lead them to paradise.
Exactly.
And they believe him.
Because why wouldn't they? That's what was designed, and that's what Paul now bought into. Okay. Chani's on board in the books. Chani is on board. There's no fighting about it. It's just, my partner is the one who'll say
this. Do you think Chani is written better like this, though?
I think she's more interesting like this.
Yeah,
I think in the first book, she does not get a lot to do. I think this gives her more agency. It's the biggest departure is Chani's behavior. Chani is beside Paul at the end. There's a really good speech where the princess, Florence Pugh's character, Paul is like, look, I'll marry your daughter. And then she's like, oh, okay. And then it's like a business deal and we'll give you kids and all this kind of stuff. And Paul is like, no. The only thing you'll have of me is my name. Like, he's like, Chani's
like
the one.
He never even touches her.
No. Like, and Jessica, who was not married to Oscar Isaac, Duke Leto, she was like, look, history will remember us as wives. Like, she's not, like, you're Paul's person in everything. And she's just his wife because it's convenient for legal reasons. Like, she has nothing, you're better off.
And they don't do that. What they do is actually a really great scene of, and Zendaya fucking smashes out of ballpark, is that look into the camera, or her looking at Paul.
Yeah.
And within that one scene, like, you could see everything. Like, the last 12 months or a year or whatever, however long it's been, where she's just looking at him like, you fucking bastard, like, what are you doing? But then she's also like, she's mad, there's so much conveyed, because she's like, you've gone and married Florence Pugh, which is number one, obviously, if they're in a romantic relationship. But the other part is like, she's like, oh shit, you're Space Hitler, like, and you told me you wouldn't be.
Yeah, they have that thing, and it's like, I love you as long as you stay yourself.
I breed.
Yeah, as long as I breathe and as long as you stay, you keep being yourself or something like that. And he's changed. He's changed utterly. Like, he's a completely different human by the end of this.
And I think it's really well acted, just from Zendaya's point of view, is that, like, that's all conveyed with just one look. And the great scene of everyone bowing and only the three of them still standing. And Chaddy's like, I'm not fucking bowing. Like, I'm not bowing to you.
So good. Yeah. Like, I don't bow to you. You're not in charge of me.
Yeah, like, we're 50-50 or we're nothing.
Exactly. That ending of her on the sandworm riding away. I have no idea where that plot line is going. Like, that's a complete departure.
But I love the fact that, like, Paul has said, like, she'll end up by my side, which is fine. Like, she can end up there, but it's how we get there. I think that's such a great, as you said, it adds a lot of agency to that character. Even if it's different from the book, like, it makes that character so much more interesting that she's the only one. Like, it's amazing that the only character that doesn't believe in him is the one character who's in love with him.
Yeah.
So everybody else loves him, but she's in love with him. And she's like, you are not the Messiah. Like,
that's the thing,
I know
she knows
you.
Him. The rest of them just know the idea.
Yeah, they're like, the idea of him is like, oh, he's the Messiah. And she's like, he's just fucking Paul. What are you talking about?
Do you want to talk about the baby?
Which baby?
The fetus.
the talking baby.
The talking baby.
Yeah. As far as I know, that is an actual child in the book.
Yes. So, when Jessica does the drinking the Reverend Mother potion, it happens quite like that, that the baby becomes pre-born, she's awake, and she has all the memories of her ancestors. In the book, she's then born, and she's like two by the time the finale takes place.
Right, okay.
But she's walking around being a little fucking freak and weirding everyone out. Because she's like, oh, I've seen you die, and that kind of stuff.
Like Paul on steroids, like full freak from even day one.
From day one, just a weirdo.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's walking around. She ends up, she kills the Baron in the book.
Right, okay, the Harkonnens. You
know, the Harkonnens, yeah. So she, you know the Gamjabar? The little poison dart thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She does that to him. And, like, she's a two-year-old, kills him, overpowers the other Reverend Mother with her mind.
That would be very difficult to shoot, I think.
Very weird cell. Yeah. Yeah. They do it in David Lynch's Dune, and it's very strange.
See, I love the fact, like, Denny knows, right? So this dude is fucking weird. Like, it's so weird as a book.
The first one is the most normal.
Yeah, and it gets weirder. And I think Denny's, like, walking a fucking tightrope since the very first one. Like, how weird do we get? How much do we let out of the bag to audiences? Because there's going to be a moment for everyone where they jump off. Where they're like, oh, this is
too
fucking
much.
Mad. This is insane.
And it never happens in this movie. To me, anyway.
Not once. There's not once in this movie does it happen. Now, in Messiah, there's probably going to be a much bigger contingent that will probably be like, this is super weird.
It's going to get weird.
I think what explains that is a lot of people at the end of this movie came out thinking, well, Paul's the hero. He won.
Yeah. Yeah, like, if you're just casually watching this, you're like, oh, okay, the protagonist of the story ended up on top.
Yeah.
But, like, what does that mean? Paul's a fucking, he's a 19-year-old in charge of all of humanity now.
Yeah, and look, that scene of them in the tent in part one is now made a million times better, where he starts freaking out because he's like, you did this to me.
Like, I didn't want this.
There's, all these people are going to die because of me. And he's still Paul at that point. Yeah. And I love the fact that, like, when he's just Paul, like, he gets ideas. He can see bits of the future. Like, very vaguely, he kind of gets a vague idea of what's going on.
So, can I talk about that for a second? Yeah. It's really cool. So, in the books, Paul is trained as a mentat. So, we saw one of them in Dune Part 1. They're basically, like, AI and technology, a lot of it is outlawed in the Dune universe. So, they have people who are trained to act as computers and stuff like that. So a lot of Paul's early prediction and stuff like that comes from, one, spice exposure, which can help open your mind a bit, and two, just running calculations in his head about what's the most likely thing to happen.
Right, okay.
Which is a really cool way of doing it. It's not touched on in this because it's not cinematic at all, but it's a very cool
way of handling it. The only time you see it is when Oscar Isaac's characters, like, they travel across the galaxy to get us to sign this one piece of paper. How
much
would that
cost?
Yeah,
and his eyes go back and it's, yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool. Yeah, but it's made... That scene in the tent is a lot more harrowing now because he knows it's coming.
Yeah.
And he's like fighting against it throughout this whole movie. And Timothée Chalamet does a great job of just being like, no, that's not me. That's not me. But there's like a really good subtlety to it because he's like, I'm not the Messiah. But simultaneously, I want all Harkonnens dead. Like, they killed my family. They killed everyone I loved. I'm with the Fremen until the end. But then the Fremen are like, he's with us till the end. That's exactly what the Messiah would do. Like, listen, Al-Ghaib. And Javier Bardem is fucking great at doing that in this movie.
So good.
Kills it. Just the comedy alone is so funny that he's just, no matter what he says, he's like, that's exactly what the Lisan Al-Ghaib would say.
And it is funny, and it got laughs in the cinema.
Yeah.
But then you realise, like, no, that's the kind of belief that, like, led Paul to this. Like, just blind faith put this objective psychopath on the throne.
Because he's just driven by revenge until the end of this movie.
Exactly, yeah. Like, there is no Messiah. Like,
that's the take.
It's created. Being a messianic figure helps Paul get revenge.
Exactly. So, yeah, the idea is, and look, we're from Catholic Ireland, so I mean, we're allowed to say this, but the idea is that Paul realizes that by acting like this character, the Fremen will help him get his fucking, because he's like, I'm going to get revenge, but he's like, I'm just one guy.
Yeah.
Like, I can't do it by myself. And me and my mother are just going to walk up and kill all the Harkonnens. Well, this planet is covered with Fremen. So he's like, in his head, he just runs the very quick calculation of like, okay, well, I need the Fremen to help me achieve my goal of revenge. And they need a Messiah figure. So I'm going to be the Messiah figure and then they will follow me into battle.
It's like, and there's that bit where he's talking with Jessica and she's like, your father didn't believe in revenge. He's like, well, good thing I'm not him then.
Yeah, because he's like fully just like, we're going to kill them all because they kill. And you know what? What works in this is that you understand that. You completely understand the logic of like, because in part one, they are all brutally murdered. Everybody is brutally murdered. Like, just, everybody knows.
He is a child. Like, you see him, he is a child in the first movie.
Yeah, and like the idea of like this 17-year-old or 18-year-old, the next thing you're going to want, I'm going to get revenge for my dad.
Yeah.
Like, how... So
when he's in that room and he's talking to everyone and getting everyone to believe and like, oh, your grandmother, the Dune name drop is fantastic as well.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, and the music fucking swells up and you're like, oh, shit.
And then he's in the middle of the room and he pulls out his father's signet ring.
Yeah.
And it cuts to Gurney's face and it's just like, oh, okay, he's the Duke. He's still the fucking Duke.
Because there's still the Duke in there. Like,
yeah.
Now he even, and I think that's like the one time that like I really started freaking out because like he's full on Messiah mode at that point. Like he's drank the fucking thing. Like he's full on gone fully insane. but there's still like 1% of Paul in there. They're like, I'm the Duke.
Like, yeah.
And there's he doesn't really need to be the Duke. They don't care that he's the Duke, the Fremen don't. But at that point, it's still in him. He's like, I'm my father's son.
Yeah, and what's really interesting is that in the book, there's a lot of... there's a lot of just people thinking. So in the movie, by design, you just see Paul as people see him most of the time.
Yeah.
Like as this messiah figure who's a leader and all that. But in the book, you get a lot more of like, oh, I'm pretending to be a messiah, but I really miss my dad and I wish I could cry.
Which like, is... That's exactly, that's the plot.
There's more of Paul personality in there still in the book, you get in glimpses in the film by nature.
But to be
of just
fair,
how it works.
That's just what we've been talking about. Like, we got that. We're idiots. But yeah. I was watching it and I completely understood that Paul is not actually believing he's the Messiah, but it's for a greater good. He's like, I want all Harkonnens dead. Okay, there's this A to Z. Z is dead Harkonnens. A is where I am now. Okay, all the rest of the steps are, I need to convince them I'm the Messiah. And then I'll have an army of 10 million. And then we can go fuck them up.
Yeah, with big worms and stuff.
Big worms and stuff. Okay, we talked a lot about the kind of plot and Paul, and he's like the driving force behind it. Best performances. Very tough to kind of give out, because, I mean, look, I'm going to rattle them off. You got Timothy. He kills it. Zendaya. Fantastic.
Yeah.
You've got Rebecca Ferguson, who...
Fucking unmatched, like...
Rebecca Ferguson is a full-on psychopath in this movie, but, like, plays it so well. The bit where she's like, we'll get the weak ones first. I was like, holy shit, okay. Josh Brolin loves nukes, fair enough. He just kind of plays classic Gurney.
The bit... I like the way they reunite.
That's true. I recognise your steps, old man.
It's so fucking good.
And then he's like the young pretender. And that's all really good. Christopher Walken is... I thought he was going to Christopher Walken it up a bit more. He doesn't really get a lot to do because Florence Pugh is the driving force behind that whole area. And Dave Bautista... I mean, Dave Bautista is so good in such a small role that...
I buy that he's like... He's... You know, angry and aggressive, but he's also afraid.
Like, he's angry to cover how afraid he is of his uncle.
Yeah. Like, he's terrified of him.
Yeah, because he's always losing. But he's always losing because he always tries to impress too much.
Yeah.
And the best scene ever is the bit where they walk into Paul and all the Fremen in the sand, and he runs away immediately. Yeah. And you're like, oh shit, he's actually a coward. Like, he's terrified once he actually gets in there.
Yeah, the look on his face when one of the Fremen, the Fedaken, when they attack him while he's on the helicopter,
and
with their dying breath they shout Muad'Dib. There's just a look of like, oh fuck, this is bigger than we thought.
Yeah, because he's just trying to impress his uncle, and he's like, I'm in too deep. Oh, like, I'm not suited for this. I look like Dave Bautista, but Dave Bautista is such a good actor that he can show the fact that he is actually scared. Like, it's in his eyes.
Yeah.
They're like, what the fuck am I doing here?
Oh,
I could die at any moment. I wanted to touch on, obviously, Stellan Skarsgård, who had to sit through 8 hours of makeup, is fantastic.
Fair play to him for doing that, because that would drive anyone insane.
Javier Bardem is excellent. I want to bring up Austin Butler because...
Very bald in this movie, isn't he?
The baldest man.
Might be too bald.
Sean, Austin Butler or Rebecca Ferguson, who has the better performance?
Dude, I was genuinely surprised by Austin Butler's performance in this movie.
Yeah.
He is fully insane in this.
Like, in the best possible way, he's chewing... Every scene he's in, just gobbling every scene he's in.
That Colosseum fight on the Harkonnen planet.
Getty Prime, and it's in black and white because the black sun that the planet has.
It's filmed with ultraviolet cameras. Like, it's insane.
It's insane.
Fucked.
Denny, you didn't have to do that, but he did.
Yeah.
And like, you have the big fight scene. You have him licking the fucking blade. He's so good that he's standing beside Stellan Skarsgård, and everyone's just looking at him.
Yeah.
And like, Stellan Skarsgård in the first movie is so vicious and so violent and so like scary. And then if you put Skarsgård and Batista and Austin Butler in this movie in the same scene, there's only one person everybody's looking at.
Yeah.
And it's the fucking psychopath.
Yeah, because it feels like he could do fucking anything at any moment. Like,
yeah.
Well, say in the book, he doesn't have a weird cannibal sex cult in the book, but that was something Denny added.
That's just a little bit of a tidbit to throw
in. And there isn't as much with, I forget the actress's name, Margot Fenring is the character, the Bene Gesserit.
Lea Seydoux.
Lea Seydoux, that's her. That's more elaborated on in the movie. It's only kind of hinted at in
the I have
book.
A question, Sean.
Yeah.
Did he stick his dick in that box?
Someone made one of those, actually. They made the pain box that you can fuck.
Because when she pulls out the box, I'm like, he's putting his dick in that box. I know for a fact he is.
Yeah. He's like, if there's one man who would enjoy it.
If there's one man. By the way, his performance throughout it is outstanding. Like, it's... To be honest with you, he probably should win the Oscar for this before Elvis. Like, his performance in Elvis is good. This, I think, is like his peak performance I've ever seen him in. The bit at the end when Mayday Knife
Chip and Shatter,
and when Timothy says it to him, and then he says it back, and the way he says it back is one of the best, like, just reactions to that.
Yeah.
Because
he's
much
amused.
Is conveyed.
And, like, he's muse curious, kind of insulting, like...
And also kind of turned on, I think. I think he loves Timothy. I think, like... Because I know in the book, they are meant to be romantically linked because Timothy's meant to be a girl.
Yeah, exactly. So, it makes sense that they have chemistry.
So, as far as I know, this could be completely wrong. So, the Bene Gesserit sets it up that Rebecca Ferguson is going to have a daughter. And then that daughter is going to marry... Fade Ruta, so that's Austin Butler's character. But then Rebecca Ferguson goes against the wishes, and she has a boy.
Yes,
which means they could still get married. I'm assuming gay marriage is legal in this universe, but it kind of ruins their idea of you're like looking into the distance, like I don't know. But
I suppose it
fucks with the Bene Gesserit plan that they had written down. Because now because in this universe, like, they have the kings or whatever, the kings and queens, and the kings are, you know, the patriarchy. And so now Rebecca Ferguson has Timothy, and Fade Ruta, Austin Butler is there, and now they're enemies, because only one of them can be the chosen one, or the messiah that they were born to be. So that battle is so good.
Such a well-choreographed fight. Very personal, like very intimate. Like the Fade Ruta seems happy to die at the end of this.
No, he is so ecstatic constantly when Timothy's there. Because it's the first time he's ever met anyone who kind of gives
like
off
him.
The same energy as him. And he's like, holy shit. This guy, that's why I was like, he's fully turned on right now. Like, he kind of is in love with him because...
Oh, yeah, big time.
Because he's like, this is the only person ever who's ever challenged me and is talking like a fucking badass. Even my uncle is scared of me. Like, his uncle is just like, yeah, you're the best. And it's the only one is Paul who's like, fuck you, I'm in charge. And Fenru is like, holy shit,
let's
go.
There's a great moment where Paul uses the voice on the Reverend Mother.
Yeah.
And tells her to show. And Fenru is just like, holy shit, this dude's awesome.
Fenru looks at him and he gives him a look like, oh shit, you are a fucking legend.
he would want to be friends if he didn't want to kill him so
like
bad.
They would be. He wants to be best friends with Paul, but he also wants to kill Paul.
Yeah, it's a very, very tough situation.
Because Fade Ruta is a very fucked up individual, and his version of, like, if he likes you, he wants to kill you.
Yeah, and the bit before that, where, just another great Paul bit, is where he's talking to the Fremen when they have, like, everyone hostage, and he's just like, all right, bring up the Emperor and his daughter and his retinue, and then kill all the Sardaukar, who are like the best soldiers in the galaxy. But he's like, no, the Fremen have this handled. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Because, well, to be fair, right, we do need to talk about the big battle scene. We need to talk about still a lot of stuff, but yeah. Like, there's so much in this fucking movie, man. And I know some people were complaining that it was boring. I never felt bored once whole thing.
I was gripped. I think I could understand where it could be boring,
yeah.
But I just didn't experience that. I was just caught the full time.
Yeah, like it's one of those where if someone says to me they didn't like the Batman, I'm like, cool, that is not the experience I had. Like, the yeah. experience I had was like, I was locked in. And in this movie, I was also locked in. Moment yeah. one, I was like, holy shit, they're actually doing this.
You're not wrong, and people can have different opinions. That's absolutely yeah.
Encouraged. And so, I mean, you have that bit, the fucking worms at the end.
Okay.
Man. Oh my
worms.
God. Okay, Daddy, you're a fucking lunatic, first and foremost. Like, you're a madman. There's yeah. no need to pull that out. And why does it look so good? Why does it look so perfect? Why is every movie even trying, every other movie? If this is what we can put on the screen for less money than it takes Secret Invasion to make the world's worst series.
I had to, multiple times stop myself and say, hey, this isn't real. Because I fully buy this world.
Like, everything is real. Like, you can touch it. I don't yeah. know how he did that. And I want to know, but I also don't want to know because it'll ruin the magic. I just want you to be like, Denny, I appreciate you. That's all I need you to know.
I never want to watch a behind-the-scenes featurette on this movie. I don't want to know how it was made.
Like, when those three worms come up, and yeah. all the Emperor's men, because it's set up so perfectly, because the sandstorm comes in, and they're all fucking, they all get a bit knocked down, and like, Chani's fighting one half on the other side, and then like, all the men get back up, and they all pull out their swords, and they're like, we're about to fuck up these Fremen, and yeah. then the fucking worms come up out of the sand.
And all bets are off.
And like, the three of them, all of them are fucked, like, they all know immediately, it doesn't matter how big your sword is, that yeah. worm is going to eat everything there.
I love the effect of the Fremen coming out of the sand as well. It's so yeah. fucking cool every
like,
time. Well,
they show it constantly. Like, that's literally the first 5 minutes of the first movie.
Yeah.
Is they show the Fremen are part of that planet. And, like, they know it better than anyone. Especially the Emperor's army, who don't know that fucking planet at all.
Yeah.
And the Fremen are now there, and it's finally their chance to take over.
And, like, Paul's father understood that the way to like really control the planet is to get in with the Fremen and be good, be cool with them.
And work with them.
Which is why Paul like knew enough about Fremen stuff, he studied it to get by and to survive long enough to be accepted in. There's that bit where Chani is teaching him how to sandwalk. And he's like, oh, but in the books I've read, this is how you do it. And he just shuts up immediately. Cause he's like, no, you know more.
But it also, that's a great character thing of like, he's trying. Like, he yeah. never once insults them. He's like, I think this is how we do it. Like, I don't want to fucking cause a problem. I think this is how we walk. And Chaddy's like looking at him, I'm like, just trust me. Like, this is yeah. how we do it. Now, there's probably, the only bit that I'm not going to say I didn't like it, but that bit that they never showed him doing the trials in the sand, which was a bit weird. I thought they probably should show, because they're like, we're going to send you out by yourself. Nobody can survive that hill. And you're never going to be able to reach that point. He's definitely going to die. And then yeah. it just skips on. And I'm like,
yeah.
I wanted to have that scene. Now, maybe they thought, look, the 3-hour movie, it's already too long. Let's cut out that 5-minute scene. I would have preferred to see Paul struggle a little bit and, like, barely survive something.
Fair. Yeah, I think it is purely for length that that's done. It's not hugely featured in the book. A lot of it is they do the Reverend Mother process thing. Then I think there's a bit of a time jump and it picks up at the worm ride.
Right.
Because that's the most important thing, really, is to... You're not a full Fremen until you've done that.
Do you want to talk about that scene?
Fuck yeah, I do. That's incredible.
I think it might be top 3 scenes I've ever seen, ever, in film.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. It's outstanding.
I mean, if you see it in IMAX and you have the sound, do you ever see that clip of, it's always on Twitter, of like the guy sitting up when he's playing video games?
Yeah, yeah.
I was literally fucking sitting forward the whole time. Like,
and my hands were sweaty. I was like, I was gripped.
I think I didn't breathe for like a good 2 minutes, where I was just like, what is happening? This is amazing.
I felt like I was like, under my breath being like, run, 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 run. Yeah. Like, just, it takes you along for the ride. Like,
the sound design, when he falls off that sand and he's trying desperately to grab onto something, and he swings the hook back and he gets into something. And the sound design of that is, I think it's the best sound design I've ever heard.
Sound design is out. It's incredible. I don't know
like,
how.
I was like, I was just there. Like, I was so locked in. There was nothing going on in my brain other than, oh, holy shit, this is real. He needs to hold on to that worm.
Yeah. And like the worm, when it's coming through the dunes, those thumpers as well, you feel that in your stomach.
I mean, the sound design, whoever did sound design, you are a genius.
you sold your soul to someone and it was so worth it.
I don't understand, because everything in it is so visceral. Like, I do have a complaint, Sean. My complaint is, Hans, coming for you, you didn't put the screaming lady voice in enough. I want more screaming lady voice. That is number one's best asset.
You want Wonder Woman 84 level of screaming.
No, maybe not all the time, but I'm talking, like, in the first one, it happens like 4 or 5 times, and like the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. In this one, I only counted 2. Useless to me, Sean. I want 10, 15 times.
Give me the woman screaming cut.
I've been trying to replicate the scream ever since, and I can't really quite guess. I can't get the right.
I'm going to be
timbre.
Honest. I don't think your voice box is built for it. To be honest,
it's not built for it. And I've been trying, but it's not. It's not there. It's not inside me. Are you looking up who did the sound design?
Trying to find it, but it just bringing up Hans Zimmer, and it's like, no, I know that's not it.
He's the music. Yeah,
he did the score.
Dude, yeah, the score
I might be a minute here looking. Zimmer. Looking through IMDb here, I don't want to take off too much time, but I feel it's deserved.
I think whoever did that, the sound design is what I mean. I don't know what they should do, but they should win an Oscar for definitely. I'll be honest with you, Oppenheimer. If I was Christopher Nolan, I would be fucking ecstatic that this movie got moved back, because I'm going to be honest with you, Oppenheimer's a fantastic film. Like,
this is better.
It's not beaten this. Like, it's just not. I don't know if people will agree or disagree, but Christopher, this movie was originally meant to come out last year, and it got pushed back to March. And if not, it would have been up for that Oscar. Christopher Nolan wouldn't have gotten it. I also don't think probably Cillian Murphy would have gotten it. Maybe he still would have, but like, you would have had Timothy up there beside him. Like, it would have been, if this doesn't walk the Oscars next year, then
This is a sweep, surely. Batman as well is pushed back, so that is not even up for contention. Also, you're going to fucking love this. I found him. Dude who did sound design, Dave Whitehead is his name. Worked on District 9, Blade Runner 2049, Dune. Also, sound effects editor on Moonfall, Connor. And I think we said in our review, it sounds amazing.
Everyone's allowed one miss, right? He needed the paycheck. I assume he needed the paycheck when it came to Moonfall.
Oh, 100%.
Imagine doing the sound design for Dune 1 and 2 and Blade Runner 2049 and then being like, hey, are you around to do the sound design for Moonfall, a movie where the moon falls? And that's
he's like,
the plot.
Fuck yes, I am.
And I'm like, yeah, fucking hell I am. You're goddamn right, get in.
And then he did Snowpiercer as well.
Holy shit.
This dude's done it all.
So you're telling me he did Snowpiercer and Dune. Is he your favourite sound design person?
I think he might be.
Yeah. Did he do 28 Days Later? Because that's the Holy Trinity if he knocks that out of the ballpark.
No, but he did Chappie, which is pretty good. And yeah. Lord of the Rings, Return of the King, Two Towers, and Fellowship of the Ring.
Oh, I suppose he's done something there.
I guess he's pretty good.
I guess he's all right. Fucking hell. So when we're saying Denny has assembled the Avengers, he assembled the Harlem Globetrotters. He just, yeah. He was just like, he went to round for every single person, I assume, on the crew, and no matter who you were, oh, are you the best at holding a boom in all of the world? Okay, yeah. You're in the crew.
Which is why I think it's like, it is Lord of the Rings trilogy good, potentially, because everyone gave a shit about making this a good production.
And like, I think the cast actually comes last, and I think with that, like, everything else is so good that when, how, my brain is actually cannot comprehend assembling that cast. No, sorry, assembling the crew and being yeah. like, okay, we have the best cinematographer, we've got the best editor, we've got the best music, we've got the best sound design, we've got the best director, we've got the best fucking cameramen in all of the fucking world, best sound people, best everything. And then being like, cool, now let's assemble the greatest cast ever as well to put with them.
Like, it must be the dream call to be like, hey, Villeneuve wants you in the next Dune movie. Or is it just his next movie?
Well, like
general?
Him or Nolan or Greta. Like, if you're getting the call for any of those three, you're like, you're in my next movie. You're yeah. like, this is going to be great.
Or Yorgos Lanthimos, who makes fucking weird movies, but they're apparently yes. the easiest way to get an Oscar now.
I'm fantastic. I mean, like, I think, like, there's several directors that they're great directors, but, like, it's who they work with as well. And you see yeah. a lot of the same people. Like, Denny always works with some of the similar people.
That's it.
Well.
He's Ocean's 11-ing film production.
Like. it's Ocean. Like, who's the best at this very specific thing? You get them in.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much we need to talk about still.
We could do 4 hours on this movie. Like,
Rebecca Ferguson.
Kills her.
Just a psychotic, manicidal, like, maniac.
Yeah, unnerving to watch at points, which I think is yes. a high praise for a character that's meant to be unnerving.
Especially because in the first movie, she's the point of reason. She's yes. fully the anchor, where things are falling around everyone, and Timothy's freaking out, and she's like, you're coming with me. Come with me, and I'm the leader here, and I'll look after you. As like, that's a mother and her son. And she's yeah. like, I'm gonna lead us out of this. And in this one, like, she's, as we say in Ireland, Sean, she's away with the fairies. She's yeah. she's God. Like, Timothy's by himself.
Her transformation as well, with like, from going from just looking like the Lady Jessica to then, like, after the time jump, and she has like the face tattoos and everything yeah. like that. Like, she again, once she does that transformation, she's completely different. It just changes you.
Like, and her body movements change, her posture is just completely different, the way she says, like, Rebecca Ferguson is so good, like, outstanding in that role. Yeah. Like, it's one of those where, like, she's so good that, like, Austin Butler is also so good. They're both, like, 10 out of 10. It's very hard to be like, that's the best performance in the film.
Exactly, yeah. Like, I don't know, Rebecca Ferguson could win from what she's done on this Dune movie. She could be up for best actor, best female actor, but I think it'll be put down to supporting.
I think supporting for her and Zendaya might be up for best actress.
I'd believe that. Like, unless something drastic happens in the next
I assume that's probably how they're going to run
it. That would be what they would submit for, but I think...
And then Timothy and Austin, the other side.
Yeah, like, to be fair, it could be every... supporting character could be a supporting actor or actress not in this. It's,
and look, the Oscars don't ultimately matter. We're just literally trying to put into context in our own brains. I suppose yeah. like, consciously we've always grown up that, like, oh, the Oscars are the best things ever. There's lots of good movies that didn't win any Oscars. The Batman didn't get nominated for Best Cinematography. Have you seen that movie?
That's insane.
that's a personal gripe of mine. But, like, the Oscars don't ultimately mean anything, but I think it's good... In our brains, that's how we structure, okay, this is good enough to be in the running, surely.
Exactly, like, yeah. This arbitrary award that we've decided is the highest...
that means something.
Yeah, the highest achievement in cinema.
Like, it means something now because Killian won it, but next year if somebody we don't like wins it, it doesn't mean anything. It's that's kind 100%. Of that's the role we're going
with.
As
simple as that, lads.
There's a Cork lad currently the champion, boys. You better step up or get stepped on, you know what I mean? There's other seeds we want to talk about. Is there anything else that stood out to you?
The Gurney Halleck versus Raban fight. Very brief fight at the end. But I like that Gurney just basically pastes him immediately.
Because Dave Bautista is not, he's not the best.
No.
Like, that's the best part of his character, is that, like, he kisses fucking Austin Butler's boot, and he's just, like, terrified of everyone, and he looks like Dave Bautista, which is why everyone's terrified of him. But ultimately, he's actually not that good at fighting.
No, he's just, he's middle management, and he has been the entire time in these movies and books.
And he's just coasting, like, he's hiding in middle management, being like, I'm the nephew. Of the leader.
I'm trying to think, is there any other drastic differences between, like, book and movie? And, like, there's not a huge amount, and if they are, they don't really matter. It's mainly the daughter, Alia. Lovely to see Anya Taylor-Joy pop up.
True.
And then the Chani stuff and her riding away at the end just doesn't
Can I ask
happen.
You, what did you think of Chani and Paul's relationship in the movie?
Super believable. Like, they have good chemistry. They are friends anyway, like in real life, so I'd hope they can get on well together.
Well, he's the American Tom Holland.
He is the American Tom Holland, to be fair.
Or is Tom Holland the British Timothy Chalamet? That's the question.
Who's younger or more successful?
I think Chalamet is younger. I think.
Really?
Maybe by like a year or two.
Have you ever seen him doing Xbox controller mods on his old YouTube?
Oh, what a legend.
It's hilarious. It's so good. I buy them as... I like the development of their relationship.
Mm.
I like how she fucking can't stand them at the start.
You know what? I actually think that's a great kind of way to put it. It's believable. So a lot of people say, like, in terms of role, it's not this whirlwind romance. It's somebody who, like, it's a weird thing because he knows he loves her even though he's never met her.
He's been dreaming about her and all the rest of
it. Like, she's literally like the woman of his dreams, literally. For at the end of one, and she's meeting a stranger, and she's like, "You're a bit intense," and he's like pure love bombing her, just like, "I love you so much from day one."
The scene where he has a vision of the atomics going off,
and she explodes,
her face melts off. Oh, it's fucked.
Yeah. but their relationship, I think, is actually, it works really well because it's slowly built on her side. Like, he's already at 10. He's already like, "I'm ready to marry her for the rest of my life and just be with her." And she's like, "Who are you?" And he kind of has to gain her respect. And even, like, when they're in a relationship, she's still a bit wary of him, which is it's a very good character trait because she's not, like, he's not the messiah to her. She's just like, "What do you really want?" And then he finally, like, gains her trust, but then he starts acting a bit weird. And she's like... "This is weird. What are you doing?
I didn't sign up for this. Like,
I'm getting bad vibes."
Yeah, and the stuff as well with Jamis, who is the dude that Paul killed.
I like how he just imagines this one guy, and the one guy's like, "Drop fucking nukes, bro."
Yeah, it's like, commit to it. It's like that. That's an interesting way of having his first kill mean more, like. Because it's an extended thing in the books of, like, Paul cries at his funeral and that's how people start again believing in him and stuff like that.
Right, okay.
Because he's shedding water for the dead. But I don't know. I like the idea that in another world, because we see those visions in the first one, Jamis, like, guided Paul. So Paul can see that possibility and what Jamis would advise.
But also, clearly Jamis was terrible at guiding him because he was like, "We need to fucking drop some nukes."
See, there's the theory that I'm seeing is that Rebecca Ferguson fucking planted some of that in his head. It's just
what do
a theory.
You mean, though? As in, like, in through the Water of Life?
Not through the Water of Life, but just through Bene Gesserit tricks.
Like, Bene Gesserit are
very
mind tricking.
You can't count on him for much.
I actually had a very... I was talking to a man who used to be on the show, Conor Martin, very big fan of Star Wars. Hosted a few episodes very early on of this podcast.
He's a good lad.
A good lad. Well, a friend of the pod. And we were chatting and he loves Star Wars. And something visceral just came out with me. After I watched this movie, I just became like a hater. And I came out and like in the group chat, I was just like, this is 10 times better than every Star Wars movie that's ever been made. And I put that in.
I don't think
willing to
you're
get
wrong.
Roasted. Right? Yeah. And I put it in and immediately got roasted. They were like, oh, come on, that's a bit fucking strong. Understandable. I immediately backtracked. But there was just a feeling. I came out of the cinema and I was like, why can Star Wars not do this?
This is the thing. It's like Star Wars is basically Dune. Like, it's just worse family-friendly Dune.
Yeah, like George Lucas obviously read Dune. He loved Frank Herbert. He took the Messiah thing and went different directions with it. But like, that's the idea. But like, I came out with this and I was like, the fact that Star Wars culturally is such like, it's Star Wars. Like culturally, you don't think you get bigger than Star Wars. And so, I think culturally Star Wars is bigger than Lord of the Rings. Which is probably a struggle, but like people who've never seen either movie, but if I said Darth Vader, they'd be like, yeah, I know who that is.
Exactly, yeah. But if there's a chance.
If I said Aragorn, they'd be like, yeah, I vaguely.
What,
I've
that
heard
blue
it,
dragon
yeah.
from the early 2000s?
Yeah. It's not like shitting on Lord of the Rings, also one of the biggest properties of all time.
No, that's the thing.
Star Wars culturally has that, like that everyone knows what it is growing up. And
It was presented in a more accessible way, whereas Dune had to read these heavy fucking tomes until these movies came along.
Is this Star Wars now for this generation, or is it too kind of boring?
No, I think these movies have made so much money, like that people are now interested in the books. I don't think anyone has ever known about Dune more than they do now.
Mm.
I think it's. It's so culturally in the moment, and the fact that it's like working actors who are like pop culture A-list, everyone knows them stars.
Yeah, like if you have Timothy Chalamet, Zendaya, Florence Pugh, and Austin Butler, who I would say probably are four of the best actors working of the next generation.
Exactly, and even if they weren't the best actors, even if they weren't talented actors, they're the most some of the most known faces in Hollywood.
Yeah.
So I think that does a lot towards just making it more culturally, I'm going to use the word culturally acceptable, which if you think about it, before the Lord of the Rings movies came out, you were a fucking nerd and a loser if you had read Lord of the Rings. You get me?
Until
4 years ago, if you had read all of Dune, you're a fucking weirdo.
Like, it's never ever going to overtake Star Wars. Not it will, right?
No.
Star Wars is like...
Disney will not let that happen.
Disney will not. First of all, it makes them too much money. Secondly, there's too much war under that bridge. You've got to catch up with 40 fucking 5 years of content that you just will not be able to catch up with. And so with that, but like, it's watching this that it brings something out of me that I get actually annoyed as someone who kind of likes Star Wars to be like, this should be sci-fi. Like, sci-fi should be this.
We could be eating good.
But, like, at the same time, if everything was like this, this wouldn't be this.
Exactly. This is special because it's different. And it's different because it's good.
It's different because it's genuinely 10 out of 10. Like, in every possible production aspect, in every possible thing that they could have done to bring this book to life, this weird fucking lunatic book to a screen, they just nailed it. Like, I cannot remember anything nailing the landing more. Probably since Lord of the Rings. We were like, there's no way they're going to do the three movies and get
surely
that
one
book
of them
proper.
Is going to fuck it up. Like.
Surely one of the movies is going to be bad. And you're like, oh shit, they got all three of them. Holy balls.
Like, I'm very excited for Dune Messiah. That's another one, and if I hadn't seen what I've already seen, I have no fucking clue how they're going to adapt Dune Messiah. But I trust them so hard.
Well, like, they're going to have to go full on, like, Hitler. Like, he's... pure evil. But that is going to be such an interesting concept. And we've never had that, I don't think, in like Western cinema, that like you have the full-on protagonist of the first two movies. Like, he's still going to look like him, and he's still going to be trying to achieve the same goals, but he's just going to be insane.
But the thing is that, like, I don't want to say too much, but the thing about Paul Atreides, right, is that he doesn't necessarily want to do the bad thing. It's just that he sees at the end goal, for like the best case scenario, is for all of this bad stuff to happen. At any point, he could turn off and just make everyone's lives happy. But 50 years down the line, that doesn't help anyone, you know? So he's trapped by the fact that he knows the future.
It's the fact that he knows everything.
Yeah.
Is what hinders him.
It's really interesting. If you haven't read, I would recommend reading or listening to it. The audiobooks are great too.
Like, I don't really know, like, we can cover every scene. So the scene with the worm is obviously, I think that's my favourite scene in the whole movie.
The three worms or the worm ride?
The worm ride. First worm ride is, I think it's one of my favourite experiences I've ever had in a cinema. We also have, like, I think the knife fight scene at the end, the choreography of that is outrageous.
Yeah. The slow stab as well at the end is like...
Yeah, just outrageously good. It reminded me of, like, The Raid, like, level up, full on, like, we work on this. Like, Matrix, when it first came out. Those fight scenes where you see Keanu training for 6 months for this fight scene. Like, that scene is outrageously good. There's so many good takes. And it's all built up in terms of, like, there's a whole universe. It builds up the idea that there's a galaxy or whatever that's there that, like, is yet to be explored as well, which is even more fascinating.
That's another point I want to make, actually, is that, you know, at the end where he's like, look, all the great houses are here. Tell them I'm the emperor now or I'll bomb all the spice.
Yeah.
In the books... the great houses accept it and they're just like, okay, you're the emperor now. Whereas in this, they say no, and then Paul starts the big war.
Yeah.
Bring them to paradise. Like,
which is even like that's so good the more you take it at light. Let's bring them to paradise. But like, paradise is just, we're going to nuke them all until
the Fremen
they agree with
us. So excited.
Like, yeah, because they're in charge. They've always been a minority. Always.
That's the thing. And then the first line, I think, in that Chani says...
Who will be our next oppressors?
It's fucking Paul.
Paul is the next oppressor. That's the very first line of the very first movie. I mean, I was going to say something else there about the fight. The shot, by the way. The two shots I want to talk about that I think are two of the greatest shots. So many great shots in this movie, right? So many fantastic ones. The shot of him walking through the crowd...
Yeah.
When there's like 1,000 people and they're just like splitting as he like makes his way through with the hood up. Denny, like, he creates a sense of just size.
Yeah, like, a power to Paul.
Like, the power to Paul, and just the largeness of the universe is just in that one shot of just like, there's thousands of people and they're all just looking at him. And it's shot from just above, and it's beautiful. The second shot is just before they go into the battle at the end when he raises the knife, and like all fucking 10,000 of them all start screaming back up to him, and he like screams down at them.
Yeah, and like there's shots of like the Atreides banner coming out of the sand. Like, that's fucking...
Yeah!
That sums up the story, like...
Or the explosion, like, they first drop the first bombs, and then, like, Paul is there just looking, and the explosion is just going up in front of him, and he's like, finally, revenge.
Yeah.
This is it.
Again, Christopher Nolan, like, oh, we did so many nukes in our movie.
Well, like, the idea of revenge is, like, it just gets bigger. So he kills the Emperor... And then he realises the Emperor and the Bene Gesserit are all connected and they've been working with all the other houses to get rid of the Atreides for years. And then it's like, okay, well then we need to kill everyone.
Such a speech by Christopher Walken at the end is like, your father ruled with his heart. He was a weak man.
Yeah.
And then Paul, this is like, I'm going to marry Irulan, your daughter. And there's a look that he gives, that the Emperor has, and he's like, fuck, that is the smart move. Like, yeah. you're using your head.
I get the sense, though, Florence Pugh, who, as part of the Bene Gesserit, she knew that this was going to happen. So she knew that she had to marry Paul eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's another in the book. So the Reverend Mother calls Florence Pugh, "Oh, you were my best student." In the book, she was one of her worst students. She's not a good Bene Gesserit. She
has a
basic level of training.
And I love the idea that the Bene Gesserit in this, right? So the Harkonnens think that they're like talking out of turn by like, we're going to kill Leto Atreides and all the Atreides, and we're going to do that, and we're just going to, like, the Bene Gesserit don't want us to do this, but we'll just do it. Fuck it, it's grand. And then a bit, like, I got the impression like the Bene Gesserit are actually the ones that were like planting those ideas in the Harkonnens' minds, like, you should kill all the Atreides because they're like trying to help the Emperor.
Yeah, again, that's an addition that the movie makes, is that the Harkonnens just do it themselves. The Harkonnens and the Emperor do it in the book. And then the Bene Gesserit, it's not their plan at all. It goes against their plans, in fact.
Like, in this, I get the idea that the Bene Gesserit are, like, running everything. Like, they are the driving force behind every single option that everyone takes, up until the point where Paul says silence to her. And he's like, I'm now the Bene Gesserit. I'm actually now everything.
I am in control. Like,
I am the Messiah.
Yeah. The Dune Messiah.
Fucking hell. Is there anything we missed? Because, I mean, I feel like we
there definitely is. But
for hours about this movie and how great. There's lots of greatness in it.
Yeah, we could play our famous bit of like, oh, remember that bit where. But it's just the whole movie is fantastic.
Go watch it at IMAX.
Yes. Watch on the biggest screen you possibly can.
With the
as
sound.
As loud as you can.
And that scene with him first riding the worm is, I think I just like left my body. That is what cinema is. I was like, this is cinema. This is why I watch movies. Like, it reminded me of like watching a movie when I was seven. And
it reminded me
like,
of watching Lord of the Rings for the first time.
Yeah, like it's just an out of body. Like, this is what cinema can do. This is fucking mad. Like, I stopped breathing to be like, holy shit, is he going to live? And I knew he was going to live, but I was still like, in that moment, I'm like, is he going to live? Oh my God, holy shit.
And he did. And he wrote the biggest worm there is.
Oh, yeah. I have like many just notes that I have here of the silence, that I will love you as long as I breathe.
Yeah.
May thy knife chip and shatter, I think. It's just fantastic. Stellan Skarsgård, I like the fact that like he's understated in this because Austin Butler's character, Fade Ruta, is so large that he
he does take over as like the main Harkonnen enemy in this one.
Yeah. He's just like sitting in a bathtub the whole time.
Yeah. The reveal as well of like, oh, Paul is a Harkonnen, he's half Harkonnen, so we'll fight like Harkonnens.
So Rebecca Ferguson, her mother, her father is the Baron.
The Baron, yeah.
Right, so then where's her mother? I don't know the history at all.
Her mother would have been just another Bene Gesserit.
Right, okay. So he had sex with the Bene Gesserit, and then that gave birth to Rebecca.
Yeah.
And then Rebecca gave birth to Paul.
Yes, which makes him and Fade Rautha cousins.
Fuck. Okay, so which adds to it because he's now what he hates the most. That's
exactly.
Yeah,
he's always
the
been
idea.
A Harkonnen, so then he fights like a Harkonnen. He fights dirty at the end.
Yeah, fuck.
It's so good.
There's so many layers upon layers. We might have to do a follow up review of this at some stage.
I'd be up for that. We can do a full Dune retrospective at some point.
We can talk about everything to do with Dune, but like, just go see the movie. We can't do it justice. It's just, it was outstanding, I think.
Don't wait for it to come to streaming. Watch it in a theatre. It will be better.
I think it's one of my favourite movies ever in the history of film.
It's one of the most impressive things I've ever seen.
It's impressive is the word. It's one of the, I think it is the most impressive. Maybe Spider-Verse. Spider-Verse 1 and 2 are two of the most impressive things I've ever seen on cinema. And this is right up there with just like, I just was just like, how? I'm like, how are you doing this? Like, I'm not watching Madam Web going, how did they make this? I'm like, yeah. Well, I know how they do. Like, I'm like, Denny, you fucking lunatic. How do you
do day one on this? Like, what's your first day of filming?
Yeah,
like?
What do you do day one? Like, you're in the fucking desert. Okay, what'll we shoot? Okay, yeah. Well, maybe riding the worm, I suppose. I don't know. So, like, I think that's about it for this special.
Special Movie Mondays.
Spotify will ask you a question. Please put in a comment of what you thought of Dune. If you didn't like it, that's fine. I disagree, but it's
respectfully.
Fine. Respectfully, I'm going to be that person that's seen it like 9 times at IMAX. But Sean, do you have anything else to say you want to cover?
No, I suppose, again, if you like listening to us review movies, most of the ones we do are in this kind of format where we just have a chat for a little while about them. So they're all over on the Patreon, patreon.com/heresforhirepodcast, if you do, in fact, want to check those out. But that's all the Dune thoughts I can manage at the minute, because I need to go and sort everything into my brain and figure out what's coming next.
I want to go watch it again. I'm going to watch it again this weekend. Just
good.
I need to. Like,
fuck St. Patrick's Day.
So I'm going to watch it, and then I'm going to watch it again, probably maybe 2 times more. I need to like savor it all, because I've actually seen it once. So
I've only seen it once as well. I do want to go again, and like just and just watch it. Having watched it, like, look for different things on purpose.
Sean, do you want to take us out?
Yeah, thank you everyone for listening to this episode of Movie Mondays. We'll be back on Wednesday. We'll have an episode of Weird News, and then Friday we will have A Hero or Zero. Go support the Patreon if you do want to do that. Special shout-outs go to Roisin and Baby Ben Palmer, Joe Burney, Ryan Komatsu, Dozer Enthusiast Evanson, Waffles Loves You and Hopes You Have a Good Day, David Clark, Sean Chuckle in the Wash, and It'll Be Grand Jameson, Dominic, Anna Irish Walrus Forever, and congrats Roisin on your baby, Herm Roos, Danny McLaughlin, Lord Smish, Michelle Brown, Michaela Doughty, Frost Overwhelmed by Uni and Other Bad Choices, Ed Ball, Connor and Rain Are Certain You Could Kill Someone with Just a Compass, Just Aim for the Carotid Artery, Russ, question, is David Zaslav the real-life known bastard Reed Richards without the logic Parfit? If he touches anything that Denis Villeneuve is doing, he's worse than Hitler, in my eyes. Jackson Bruha.
We're just going to put it, he's not, he's just being facetious, please.
I'm exaggerating for humour.
Hyperbole.
Jackson Bruheim decided to let Sean stay as host. Liz had a few too many on St. Paddy's Day and tipsily subscribed to the Patreon. Kira Lawler, Judge Lahey, The Amazing World of Keza, Mikey the Leinster Ledgebag, Chair's number one fan, Kyle Borowski, Rory screamed when he was responded to on Twitter, and Sean subbed to the Patreon after 10 creamy pints. Thank you all for your support. We really appreciate you sticking with us. If you want to join those people, head on over to the Patreon. There is also a merch store, heresforhire.ie/shop. Twitter's at heresforhirepod, the 4 is the number 4. Facebook is Detective Divilman's Discussion Group. Instagram is Heroes for Hire Podcast. And the best way to ever help out the show is to tell one human being that we exist.
Just the one, please.
And I think that's about it, Connor.
I think so. So I've been Connor Long.
I've been Sean Meehan.
And she'll see you all next week, guys.
Bye.
Bye.